Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
This podcast exists because of the paid subscribers at DecodingTV.com. Become a paid subscriber and get ad-free episodes as well as early access to episodes. Thanks to everyone at Decoding TV who makes this podcast possible.
Larry, how do you feel about telemarketing in general?
Well, it's a much-needed service. I mean,
well, needed by whom?
Well, needed by most businesses. I mean, in the case of CDG, it provides a public service almost by accident.
By doing what?
Providing jobs to people that are unemployable.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Streaming, a Decoding TV podcast. I am David Chen.
I'm Patrick Klubik.
Each week, This Week in Streaming, we'll cover a show that's new and interesting in the world of streaming. We'll tell you if it's worth watching, and if it is, we'll review and spoil and discuss the entire season of the show. Today, we're going to be discussing in its entirety the three-part HBO docuseries, Telemarketers. Next week, we'll be covering How To with John Wilson, Season 3, also in its entirety. These are relatively short TV shows. That's why we didn't do like a premiere review and then do the whole season review. Telemarketers is three parts. How To with John Wilson, I think six episodes, each half hour long. So we will look forward to discussing these with you here at Decoding TV and This Week in Streaming. Find more episodes of this podcast at podcast.decodingtv.com and find us across all platforms, Instagram, Threads, TikTok, at Decoding TV. I also want to mention, Patrick Klepek, you may have noticed it's a little bit of an odd time in Hollywood right now. An odd and difficult time, given that there is a simultaneous writers and actors strike going on. We fully support what the writers and actors are trying to do, but a lot of stuff in the TV and film schedule is changing all the time. It's a very fluid situation. So the next 6 months are a little bit unclear in terms of what is going to happen and what we're going to be covering. However, I do want to mention that I did make a post over at the Decoding TV newsletter, which you can find at decodingtv.com, just asking folks what you want us to cover. What are you watching? What are you interested in having us discuss here on Decoding TV? So let us know. Head on over to decodingtv.com. You can become a free or a paid subscriber. Of course, extremely grateful to paid subscribers for making this podcast possible. But if you become a free subscriber, you can comment on this post and let us know what you're going to be watching this fall. You can also always email us at decodingtv@gmail.com. But yeah, Patrick, a lot of shows in the mix there that I hadn't even thought about, which is great. You know, I look at the calendar pretty regularly. Mm-hmm. But for instance, I saw a lot of love for this Mr. and Mrs. Smith show. That's going to be coming out.
Donald Glover's in that show, right? You know, pretty much anything I'll like watch with him in it. Sometimes when we've talked about shows where we're thinking about covering, we're discovering that the release dates have shifted as we're talking about covering it. It's mm-hmm. like, oh no, that one's in. I can't remember what the show was, but there's a show you had suggested, and I was looking it up. I'm like, David, I think this is coming out in November now.
Right, that's right.
It was supposed to have come out in August.
There was a show called Murder at the End of the World that was supposed to come out earlier. I think it was supposed to come out this summer, and it shifted to November. But also saw Fall of the House of Usher. That is the next Mike Flanagan thing. I thought Midnight Mass was one of the greatest things I've ever seen in my life.
Be still my beating heart. I'm glad we're on the same page there, because I have quite liked... I pretty much like everything Mike Flanagan touches. He is essentially the cinematic equivalent of... He has the temperament of Stephen King, and obviously Stephen King being one of my favorite authors, like having someone that both understands his work, able to adapt it, and then have that same sort of tone in their own work is... I'm always excited for the next project. The most recent one did nothing for me. It didn't even make it through the pilot. Was it The Midnight Club? Or no, was it the... was an adaptation of a young adult series last year. It didn't do much for me, but this seems a little more Midnight Massy. And so I had completely forgotten that show was even coming out. Well, I mean, the ramp up to a Netflix show is usually about a week before you're like, oh, right, that's coming out. Okay.
Which, by the way, is not a terrible way to do it, I have to say. Mm. Like, how early in advance do you tell someone that something is coming out? Opinions may differ on it. You know, do you hype it up for 6 months continuously, or do you just say, hey, boom, tomorrow it's dropping? Like,
right.
What makes a bigger impact? What gets people to actually take action? I don't think it's 100% cut and dried. Anyway, thanks to everyone for sharing your thoughts, and we are incorporating them into what we're doing. So if you email us at decodingtv@gmail.com or comment at decodingtv.com, that will shape what we cover in the future. But this fall, the next big thing we're probably going to cover is The Continental from the world of John Wick. Really excited about that show. And it's basically coming out in 3 90-minute short films is what I could tell. Right? Like, it's basically like 3 episodes, each of which is like over an hour long. So
I have like no idea what to expect from it either. Like, like my expectations are not necessarily in the basement. I just don't know what a John Wick television show even is, which makes me awfully curious to see what they came up with.
Yeah, and also Loki season 2 is coming up. That looks actually honestly pretty interesting, and I think it looks probably better than Secret Invasion, but who knows? We'll see.
One that's a very low bar to like having Tom Hiddleston probably. Well, there's a lot of great actors in that. Doesn't matter. I think it's going to be good. I'm with you. I don't know what I was trying to say.
Yeah, Secret Invasion didn't hurt for good actors, but yeah.
No, that's true. That's true.
Yeah. Anyway, I again want to thank all the folks who are paid subscribers at decodingtv.com. We're entering a very not only weird time in the industry, but even if there were no strikes going on, it would be an odd time in TV anyway, because there are very few like zeitgeist-defining shows like Andor or House of the Dragon or Last of Us out right now. But I'm really grateful to Patrick Klepek for stepping into the co-host chair, and he's going to be with us for the foreseeable future.
We're the zeitgeist, David. We're making it ourselves. We're manifesting zeitgeist unto this podcast.
Indeed. We will define the zeitgeist. And so I appreciate Patrick stepping in, and your contributions at decodingtv.com help to fund this podcast and to keep it going long into the future. So thanks to everyone who is supporting us however you can. All right. So let's get into Telemarketers. This is a 3-part docuseries that recently concluded airing on HBO. It's available right now, streaming on Max, the one to watch for HBO. And I was intrigued by this documentary because, A, I'm just into documentaries in general. Patrick Klepek, I don't know how often you watch documentaries, but like they're a huge part of my media diet. And I'm just going to be hipster about it and say they were before Netflix was making 500 documentaries a year. You know, like there was a time in our lives when, you know, it was very rare to watch a documentary because they didn't come out easily accessible very often. Mm-hmm. Now, because of streaming, tons of people watch documentaries. But I
does it count if when I went to see The Blair Witch as a child that I got to the conclusion of seeing that movie irresponsibly in the theater with my father. And I turned to him and said, why would they let them show that in a movie theater? Those people are dead. Cause I didn't really fully grasp the fact that I fell for the faux documentary nature of the Blair Witch when I was, you know, 13 or whatever. I mean, and we didn't,
we were both in high school when like middle school, high school, when mm-hmm. Blair Witch came out. And like, that was, the part of the marketing was that this was a real found footage movie.
But hook, line, sinker. Just you got me, movie. There's a reason that it tormented me for an entire summer and probably remains my favorite horror film of all time, largely based on how terrorized I was as a kid.
That's amazing, though, right? Like, you could never do that today because of the internet and stuff. But back then, I remember reading an advertisement for Blair Witch Project to be like, you know, this film was the only, like, three people went into the woods. This film was the only thing that was found. And and thinking what a terrifying concept that was.
Like, try to imagine the end of that film.
Yeah.
And then looking at yourself and going, why would the police let them release this? This is terrible. And then there was the, I don't know if you ever watched like the Sci-Fi Channel documentary, like, mm-hmm. like a faux documentary they did alongside it about, like, anyway, like I could do a whole thing about the Blair Witch because of how, but like that is probably my first like experience with what we would call a documentary or like the format was the Blair Witch Project. And then for me, it's the kind of thing where, I watch documentaries in small chunks eating lunch. Like that is like what I will put on when I'm like telling myself, don't look at email. Don't look at social media. Like this is your 20 minutes to do anything other than that while you eat a salad. And
your reward is watching documentaries? Is that what you're saying?
A reward is some sort of like horrifying like documentary that like upsets me for the 20 minutes I'm eating the salad.
Excellent.
Like I'm currently watching one that you recommended, which was Burden of Proof, the one on HBO about the son who thinks his father killed his sister. So, you know, just eating this healthy salad and feeling good about myself while I clip away at this at 15 minutes a pop.
Well, anyway, as I was saying, this documentary intrigued me because A, I'm into documentaries. B, the talent attached to this documentary. Specifically, Danny McBride is an executive producer, as were the Safdie brothers. Hmm. So I'm reading here from a article in the Los Angeles Times that explains this. You know, the director, Adam Lippincern, says, quote, "I always obsessed over it becoming something." And then it was during a break in the project when Lippincern reached out to Bala Lug, a cousin he didn't know, who is a documentary filmmaker. And then that person had a deal with David Gordon Green and Danny McBride's production company. Then they came on as executive producers. And then they also took the project to Josh and Benny Safdie, who they were originally thinking could maybe direct the movie, but they also came on as executive producers. So no one wanted to direct it, but they did want to have their names attached to it. And that is fair because there's some interesting stuff in the documentary. There's all this like amazing names attached to it. So I'm like, okay, what did those people see in this project? These people whose creative taste I trust see in this project. So let's get into it. We're going to talk about our overall thoughts. Then we're going to recap and spoil the whole thing and then talk about a few additional topics after that. Patrick Klepek, what did you think overall of Telemarketers, the 3-part docuseries?
One of the strangest things I have watched in a long time. I mean that as a compliment and also perhaps a warning to others, because I think necessarily characterizing this as a true crime documentary, because of the way that format has been sort of, you know, the Netflixication of documentaries, right? I think there is a certain expectation of like what, when you say, ooh, like there's this new true crime documentary out, and it's true. There are things in this particular series that are true. There are crimes and there are cameras being held that are at times attempting the form of a documentary. As I was watching it, I was struck by, it's like, what if you just gave two amateurs all the resources to make a documentary, but didn't necessarily like walk them through what to do in that process? Just two guys who like want to Google something and like, let's find an answer. Like that's what this is. And it is fascinating the degree to which so many things are left unresolved. I think you watch a lot more documentaries than me, but the ones that I have watched over the years, like, there is still frequently an arc. It's not necessarily towards a positive resolution, mm-hmm. but there is a place that it's going to leave you at the end. And Telemarketers is not really interested in that. Or if it's interested in that, it's more about the arc of its characters doing the documentary than it is about what is it investigating. Yeah. And the over the three parts, it has a really interesting tension between like wanting to do an expose about the telemarketing industry, but also the interiority of the lives of the people and why they want to pursue this. And where you come out at the end of that in some ways is going to be how invested do you get in these characters, because I would, there's not a lot of resolution at the end. Like, there's not necessarily the sort of there's frustration. There is a resolution, but I guess it's atraditional in terms of like how I expect the conclusion of this to wrap up. And I found it to still be, I found the unsatisfying nature of it extremely satisfying because I was invested in these characters. And you know, when documentaries, I'm sure you can, when they're in multiple parts, can have cliffhangers. Few of them have the cliffhangers that you get in the second episode of this show, to the point where I had meant to text you about it because I was sort of losing my mind. I was like, what am I watching? What is going to happen in this? And we'll get into all that because it's really about unpacking these characters at the heart of it. But I, you know, if you are someone, I think like yourself, David, who has watched a lot of these, is very familiar with the form, man, if you're just interested in watching something fundamentally different, I don't know that you're going to get something, you know, you're going to get that in this show. It is just fascinating from top to bottom. And I was riveted. It cuts off in a place where I was like, I could have watched three more of these. We could have stopped investigating the telemarketers and we could have just hung out with these guys. Like, what's Pat up to? Like, I need to know. It comes with a strong recommendation. It's fascinating. It's a world that we're all familiar with and irritated with, but my guess is know very little about how it actually functions. And I was left at the end of Telemarketers wanting to do my own research into it. It's not a documentary that necessarily leaves you feeling like, ah, we've exhausted what's here. It feels like you've frankly just scratched the surface by the end of it, because that's not really the point of what they're trying to do here. But I found it fascinating and interesting all the same, even if it's as atraditional as one of these comes.
That's all very beautifully said, and I pretty much agree with 100% of that. So I don't even need to talk today. No, I'm just joking. But I think very, very nicely done, Patrick. I think that I have a couple of observations. First of all, I wasn't joking earlier when I said that streaming has resulted in a sort of revolution when it comes to documentary filmmaking. Like, we are now in the midst of way more documentaries than we ever had for most of my lifetime. And it's all because streamers like Netflix have made it really easy to access documentaries. Prior to the streaming model, documentaries were not widely commercially viable unless you had a movie like Fahrenheit 9/11 or, you know, a Michael Moore documentary. But if, hey, you don't need to worry about making money at the theater, you don't need to worry about getting people out of the theater, you can just put it streaming at home. You know, theoretically, the theory goes you can make a bunch of them, which is what Netflix has done. And we are now seeing documentaries being made about stuff immediately after it happens, while it happens, you know, in the middle of the thing, when the thing isn't even over yet.
I've been interviewed for, like, when I did reporting on a lot of the GameStop stock meme stuff that was happening back at Vice, and like Vice was producing a documentary. They had an internal documentary unit, and they were producing a documentary as it was unfolding. And I had a crew come to my house to interview me about this thing that I was not yet done reporting on. And because it was part of a race between multiple announced documentaries that essentially were land grabbing. Hey, this thing is popular. People will want to watch a like filmed Wikipedia with interesting personalities version of this. And that was like one time that I actually intersected with that because of my bunch of my reporting, like helped form the basis of the documentary they were putting together.
Yeah. I mean, people, I don't consider myself part of that people. I don't like just a filmed Wikipedia version necessarily. I want something a little bit more interesting, but if it had Patrick Klepek in it, that's like a huge selling point. That's a huge selling point for me right off the bat. Yeah, so I think as a result of that, what's going to happen is you're going to have documentaries that have unfinished storylines. Like that is what's going to happen because you're making them so quickly. Let me give you another example. Hulu and Netflix produced two Fyre Festival documentaries. Like, each produced a Fyre Festival documentary. The guy that did the Fyre Festival, he just got out of jail. He's doing Fyre Festival 2. Now those documentaries are basically incomplete. So anyway, I think a part of the reason why, like, basically I'm saying, I think this documentary feeling like it's incomplete feels of a piece with many documentaries feeling incomplete. That said, they had been working on this one for a little bit more time than many of those documentaries.
Lifetime, arguably.
This documentary like takes place, Telemarketers takes place over the course of many years. So that's just something that you made me think about. The other thing, Chris Yi Mon, we're broadcasting live at youtube.com/decodingTV. Chris Yi Mon says, did they have resources? Because they were bumming McDonald's Wi-Fi. Yeah, I don't know if I don't know how many filmmaking resources they had.
Well, but there is a sequence when they go to the police union convention or whatever.
Yeah.
I forget, like, and there's a sequence in the hotel, like in their room, where they kind of realize like they've been got. Like people understand what they're here to do, and they're worried that the hotel is going to like take their footage away or something like that. And there is like a real producer.
Right, right. It does feel like the number of resources increases as the series goes on. Like
I think the post like with the ending, like there's a
episode three,
it seems like that's when they have the connection with Hollywood.
Yeah,
and
yeah, yeah.
Like Danny McBride and like that and like the Safdies and things like that.
Yeah.
And and they do a real, and we'll probably unpack that and talk about it, but like they do a really good job of like I think they have resources. And I think I've read in some of the articles about it, like they would do conversation with this, like the Safdies about like what would be interested to read, like what should you be doing reporting on? Like here are angles that might be interesting to, but they do a really good job of just letting these two maintain the lead. Like there's people setting up lights and cameras, but you still broadly get the sense that these two, which were the heart at the beginning, remain at the heart at the end, even if they have people along the margins like helping point them in a direction or allowing them to pull off something a little more ambitious than what the two of them might do. Because yes, they still are using McDonald's Wi-Fi for huge amounts of this documentary.
I think that there are some interesting insights about telemarketing in here, but it's primarily about the people in the the series. Telemarketers is about the people in the documentary. And if you don't find them at least somewhat interesting, I don't think you'll enjoy the documentary very much, you know, because it's really becomes about them, their journeys, and what it's like for them to try to make a it's a documentary about the making of the documentary, basically, mm-hmm. right? And so the caveat is there, Patrick. If you're expecting a really lean, efficient, hard-hitting docuseries about telemarketing industry, you'll be disappointed.
Charts,
but if you want
graphs, if you want really detailed interviews with experts, like that's you still come away with a broad sense of how scummy this world is. But it is its intent is it has a narrative that is not just explicitly about informing the public about telemarketing and what's happening here.
Yeah, yeah. Last question before we dive into a more detailed discussion of the show: what has been your relationship with telemarketers throughout your life? How have you perceived telemarketers? Because I'm going to tell you right now, when I was a kid, you know, my parents, their understanding of English was not that good, but they would get these calls from these places, and they knew inherently, like, hey, I remember hearing them saying, like, I don't want to do, you know, I don't have any money, don't want to do this, da da da, hang up, like, and they would just tell me to like hang up. They understood the danger from a very young age. And it was very, from when I was a very young age, and it was very interesting to basically see what the other side of that call was from all these calls that I got when I was a kid, right? But yeah, I'm curious, like, have you ever encountered these people when you were a kid? Like, what has been your relationship with telemarketers, particularly the ones depicted in this docuseries?
Nothing like springs to mind when I was younger, but it's definitely something where I've had to have a lot of conversations with my mother, who's older now. She'll be turning 73. And it was like around like her mid 60s, like, hey, like she's got all her faculties. Like I'm not worried about her on a day to day basis, but she, like a lot of people of that age, like they can use an iPad and an iPhone and like they have a, but they like there are limits on their understanding of like technology, its relationship with data and like privacy sharing. And so my big thing with my mom is if you ever get a phone call where people need personal information, like, and like to ask for proof of it, like send something in them. If you ever the IRS doesn't call you. If someone's calling on behalf of the IRS, they can send you some paper in the mail explaining some of that, or hang up, call me. And like, I will know the red flags. Like, just say like, you're going to call back and consult your son. And like, I was like, mom, most of those places, they're just going to hang up on you the moment you say that, cause they know that they're not going to get anything from you at that point. But just never, you know, we go over the big ones like social security number, like passwords to anything, clicking on a link that you don't recognize, like never do any of that stuff. Because like the big thing that's not covered here that is different about now is how that has been digitized, right? Is scams that are occurring in email form, in text form. So for me, it's been less about like respecting the troops, like sort of what's depicted here. It's really more about telemarketers and scam artists trying to exploit the same groups of people, right? Like a lot of what's depicted in here is exploiting fixed income individuals, elderly individuals, people without support system, people without like a son to call to be like, is this fine? And so that's a lot of my interactions with it these days. Otherwise it's like, is there a new app I can download on my phone that will block more of these calls that I'm getting? You know, you still like my personal phones have like gotten better where like my iPhone will say like spam risk, you know, and you can sort of ignore something, but the call still goes through. I'm like, I still have to like hang up on it. And it's a pain in the butt, but I've never been, fortunately, like no one in my life has been fully tricked by one of those things, but I'm definitely having regular conversations with mostly my mom, cause she's the one that I interact with the most on a week to week basis to make sure that I am covering her bases on sort of like the rhetoric to look for that is going to be someone who's trying to just squeeze something out of you.
Yeah. Yeah. What a nice son Patrick Klepek is. And you know what? That's a good, I gotta tell my mom some of those things too, now that you mention it. So instead of what I've said to her before, you're on your own. No, I'm just joking. Anyway, I agree with Patrick's assessment. This is a pretty interesting show. There's some great footage in the show, interesting personalities. I would also recommend the show overall. But again, if you don't find the main characters interesting or charming in any way, it's not going to be the show for you. And I can understand that they're a little bit of an acquired taste. So those are our overall thoughts on Telemarketers.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com. One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about UnitedHealthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
All right, Patrick, let's talk about some of the stuff that actually happened in the show. Telemarketers is a true crime documentary about two former telemarketers who witnessed the corruption and exploitation of one telemarketing firm in particular, Civic Development Group, aka CDG, and they make it their life's mission to try and take the company and the industry down. At the heart of the show is Sam Lipman Stern. I think I might have said Adam Lipman Stern earlier. I apologize. Sam Lipman Stern and his
I think Adam is his cousin, right? Like the one that comes from Hollywood, yeah.
Apologies. Sam Lipman Stern and his best friend, Pat J. Pespis, who spent years working at CDG, calling vulnerable populations largely on behalf of police and firefighters unions, and asking for donations in exchange for a sticker or a decal. The two watched as CDG and the unions pocketed most of the money, with a trivial amount helping anyone the CDG marketers claimed they were intended for. While working at CDG, Sam filmed a chaotic work environment that was often filled with sex, drugs, and all manner of partying, with the first-person footage accidentally serving as Sam's route into producing a real documentary. When Sam and Pat are tipped off about how CDG's business actually works, they begin a years-long journey to interview people in and around CDG, telemarketing, police unions, Congress, and more. As the documentary is getting underway, Pat, a longtime drug addict, disappears. Let's pause there for a moment, Patrick. At the end of episode 2 of 3, the documentary really feels like it's picking up steam, and then Pat vanishes. And you said you were going to text me. Like, what was your reaction at that point? Like, tell me more about that.
Well, I mean, the end of episode 2 has Sam going around to, I think if anyone has had someone who's had struggles with addiction in their life, like, it is not uncommon that when they're missing or have not been seen, that you go to the places, which, like, a job, like regular hangouts, spots where they've been known to, you know, use drugs in the past. And you very much get the feeling that, like, as Sam is, like, pulling up to, like, looks like a sewer, like somewhere under a bridge.
Right.
And that, like, he's calling like Pat, like, I'm fully expecting, like, the next episode is going to open up with, like, him finding a corpse, around, they're not, you know, we've never, the documentary always, like, Pat is depicted as, like, a fun partier, right? Like, using drugs, like, a lot. But we never really grasp the seriousness of, like, what depths is he in? Like, is this, how much is this harming his life? How much is this, like, preventing him from escaping sort of the trap that is working for a telemarketing firm that regularly uses, like, folks in society that have a hard time finding jobs elsewhere? And on one hand, it's great that those people can get paid. On the other hand, they're also getting exploited in the process. And so at that moment, I was like, this documentary could literally go anywhere. If you told me it's going to drop the entire conceit of investigating telemarketing, and then this is going to just become about, like, Pat and his life, and, like, the conclusion of this is going to be, and actually, like, these two guys never were going to be able to take down or expose any of this. That was kind of just a fun farce that these two have been on to kind of, like, fill their lives with additional meaning. But that really the final episode would be about how this, like, firm and others like it exploit vulnerable populations, not just in how they acquire their profits, but how they acquire their labor and their workforce. And that's definitely a through line in the three parts, but is not its central focus for sure. And so it was one of those moments where, again, it only works because you've become invested in the arcs of these characters and kind of rooting for them, not even necessarily to take down this group or these organizations, because that seems probably beyond their reach, but that, I don't know, you just want to see them be happy and get something that amounts to a win. And but it also is this moment where it provides a pretty, for the first time, it feels like the documentary really kind of grounding the seriousness of Pat's situation, like something that is not shuffled off to the side, but it's definitely not foregrounded. And you suddenly have this sense, like, oh, like, the shots of, like, Pat, like, drinking and doing drugs, like, the life of the party and the legend as the telemarketer. I mean, that's all true, but then maybe that was masking something much more serious that was happening underneath. And obviously it's resolved in a much happier way by the time we pick up with them again. But that's where I ended up as a result of that moment at the end of season or episode 2.
Yeah. It's not until years later that Sam and a cleaned up and much happier Pat reunite. I think it's like around a decade or so later.
Yeah. 9 years, I think, is like when they're like having their in-person reunion. Like, I think there's a comment like, how long since you've seen each other in person? And you're right. If it's not 10 years, it was awfully close.
That's just impressive when a documentary has that much scope in general.
Yeah.
Like, it's just the idea that you're filming or pursuing this project for like 10 years or so. Is amazing. So the two collaborate with Sam's cousin Adam, who works in film and connected them with a real production crew. The documentary picks up in earnest in the final episode, culminating in a meeting with U.S. Senator Blumenthal, who once made headlines for going after corrupt telemarketing firms as a state attorney general. Blumenthal gives the pair only a few minutes only to ignore them. The documentary ends with Pat proudly hanging a photo of him and Senator Blumenthal on the wall. So, Patrick Klepek, obviously, I think a big part of your enjoyment of this documentary is whether you find Pat J. Pespis an interesting person. It is charming and at times very funny to see this guy struggle and go up against some of the most formidable forces in U.S. society. But I didn't find the interviews particularly well done. Some of them were pretty rough. Nor did I find the documentary that hard-hitting, likely because these people are not trained journalists or documentarians, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that is, I guess, both, in my opinion, a bug and a feature of the documentary. What did you think of Pat J. Pespis and him basically serving as an interviewer for many of these segments, which the director himself says, it hadn't occurred to me that Pat might be bad at this at some point. So, yeah, what did you think of Pat J. Pespis basically as the kind of proto-protagonist of this documentary?
You know, impossible not to root for. I think my favorite ongoing bit, which does get a payoff in the final moments of the documentary when they have the meeting with Senator Blumenthal, is his commitment to wearing the sunglasses in, like, everything. And, like, I love wearing sunglasses. Sometimes I wear them indoors by accident. I get it. But the commitment to wearing them when he's doing these sometimes high-profile interviews, and then I believe Sam asks him, like, clearly it's kind of been something that's been bugging him as well. It's like, hey, like, maybe take off the sunglasses. And then Pat has this moment where he's like, well, but like, I'm going to take them off, like, real dramatic, like. And, like, it was just like, I think it's one of those things we'll probably can rub people some the wrong way, the way they kind of put Pat out there to flail in front of these moments. But ultimately, I think it's really tied to the thesis of the documentary, whether it's one they knew they were doing while they were making it or one that's constructed, you know, with the help of the filmmakers they're working with. And it's something that comes together in editing where you're cobbling together a narrative out of this, like, probably tens of thousands of hours of footage that they're sitting on and sifting through. Is, like, this is ultimately a story about dirtbags exploiting vulnerable populations. And then what happens when the average person says, this is bullshit? And what happens is basically nothing. And I do think that is reflective of society where, like, I think, like, it ending with a person in power who, yes, is also part of institutions that have their own restrictions, the Senate in particular being a monstrous one. But you appeal to the people who say that they care, and they can't do anything either. And so, like, I think Pat's tenacity, like, represents the best of, like, something we all do, which is we sit around and have conversations with friends, colleagues, family, and go, man, that shouldn't work that way. Mm-hmm. And then maybe you look up about it or you watch a documentary, but you don't do anything about it. Because we as individuals, or even collectively as, like, a voting block, can just do so little to affect change. And this documentary series is like, hey, like, let's go find answers. Like, if we don't have an answer here, let's go find it somewhere else. And they take that to its logical conclusion, which is to talk to a sitting U.S. senator who has a history of working against these forces. And so I don't think the documentary series works, frankly, as well, unless Pat is at the forefront, because I think he represents the average person having average questions about feeling squeezed by the world. And watching him kind of get squished like a bug, like, along the way to trying to find those answers, I think makes the point of like, what was happening. And, like, frankly, like, the documentary is concluding moment of, dude, that guy doesn't give a shit about you. He does not care about you, about your cause. Like, the staff here doesn't. And yet he walks out, looks at this photo, and is proud of the journey and meeting this person. And that means something to him. And I think, like, those two moments side by side, like, end up making the broader, like, points of this documentary in totality.
Beautifully said, as usual, Patrick. I think I find incompetence to be much less endearing than most people. Like, I think yeah, Pat seems like a lovely human being. He's taking care of his wife who has cancer, I think, or had like some kind of severe disease. My wife also has like immune system issues, so like I've had to be very COVID careful, which also Pat is. So it was like very like I admired him just for that alone, you know. And I think it is pretty incredible that they were able to get into an actual senator's office and get an audience with them. But the fact that he handled a bunch of things kind of like, I am a person who's into competence porn personally. Like, I love seeing somebody who's really good at something execute it. Like, that's just a thing that really appeals to me. And therefore, the opposite of that is like unappealing to me, right? Is like when somebody has an opportunity and then blows it, right? Like, calling someone the wrong name, calling an interview subject the wrong name, or having a barbecue sauce on your hands when you're trying to accost someone, you know? Or in the case of Blumenthal, I thought like the interview wasn't particularly well done. Like, everyone was like, yeah, you did a great job. It's like, he didn't even ask him a single question as far as I could tell. Like, so that part I didn't find, like, I'll just say I was ambivalent on the character of Pat, on the character and person of Pat in terms of, you know, a character in this docuseries. Yes, very charming, lots of great qualities. I can understand why he'd be an affable, likable individual, but also as somebody who likes watching documentaries and investigative journalism, some of Pat's techniques or lack thereof rankled me personally. So I was a little bit more mixed on that front.
Yeah, I definitely see that, and you know, sympathize with the point. I think there's an interesting moment in, I forget where it's in the second or third episode, but broadly speaking, the documentary's framing is like Pat doing a lot of like taking his telemarketing, like his ability to talk to people, to persuade, and the theory of the case is that, well, you put him in front of these powerful people and he'll be able to elicit answers. And obviously that rarely ends up happening. But I think over the case that the kind of the course of the documentary, which kind of revealed is that like Sam is like the really smart one, right? Like, now that Pat, you know, I'm not trying to denigrate Pat's like intellectual like curiosity, but like Sam's really kind of put together. And like, there's a moment where Sam is interviewing, I think it's one of the ex FTC people that had like investigated this, and it's not a proper interview where it's like person on the left, person on the right. Instead, like the camera is like a more is one camera on the ex FTC person, and then there's a camera shot that's on Sam and Pat. But Sam is up front. Sam is like seated across this person, and so as a result, just due by physical positioning, he is leading the interview.
Yeah.
And doing a much more effective job. And there's a moment where Pat pipes in and it's not really additive. And it's sort of like it's doing what he often does, which is stumbling into a rant about how unfair it is, as opposed to like making a point and like building evidence and towards like a broader case to be effective in your sort of like argument. And you see Sam, he doesn't snap. But you can see the irritation, and he like works Pat down, and then makes his way back to like making his point in the piece. And I think like that actual like tension between, it's not really tension, because I think like Sam willingly sort of gives up that spotlight, like and frames that as a documentarian, as a creative. But I think there's like a very real world where if Sam is the one in that interview chair, you're probably much happier. Not that he is trained journalist, but he seems better prepared, like more articulate, and like could have I think bridged the gap between what you were looking for while still maintaining a lot of the sense and style of the documentary that is very unique to itself.
Yeah. Well, I think people can be mixed on Pat J. Pespa's documentarian and their opinion on him. But one of the things I really loved about this docuseries, Patrick, is by far the most thrilling part was watching telemarketers actually do their job.
Yeah.
Like when you're introduced to Pat, you it will film Pat J. Pespis doing an entire call and you see, wow, how good he is at it. And later on, there's a guy who is actively injecting drugs into himself, then does like cold call someone off of a construction line, off of a phone number he sees on the street, just cold call someone and is able to extract money from that person.
That was incredible. The battery dying. Oh my God.
That is that's competent sport I'm talking about, right? Like you're watching people who are really good at their job extract money from people, even though it's terrible. But it's also very intoxicating. I will say watching this basically junkie talk, you know, this Blue Lives Matter person out of, you know, giving their credit card up, I was like, I'm honestly not sure who I'm rooting for in this situation. but do you feel like you learned anything about what it takes to be a good telemarketer on this show? And kind of what did you think of those sequences?
Yeah, I mean, I was just impressed at people's like conversational skills. Like that is just not a skill I share. And so obviously it's being used to monstrous ends, you know, like that. Yeah. I believe there's like a one sequence where it's one of the folks who is kind of like blurred out and their voices changed. And they talk about how they extracted something like $70,000 from a guy who was clearly dying, had no one else in his life. And they were just like every week calling and just getting $1,000 on him. And so like, it's really impressive, obviously as a form of communication. And then just like the moment you snap out of like watching someone being very good at that and having those skills trained on the worst possible thing to be doing to people. And then the cutaways you get to, like the brief times you get like an entryway into these people's lives. Like, I think there's a sequence where, I don't think it's Pat. I think it's, the guy who works from home. He's the one that's always like,
the guy who call goes who killed, wrong, who killed like, someone. Yeah.
Yes. And he's always like swearing and jilting, you know, whoever, like he wasn't able to close a deal on. There's a sequence where they just go over the opening conversation, like the first like 30 seconds with a bunch of people rapidly, and it's just a bunch of people like it's a bunch of older people who just don't have people in their life, like they're just at home doing nothing. And in many ways this call from a human is like maybe the only human connection they're getting that day.
Yeah, because they'll call and they'll say, hey, how are you doing today? And then the person will say, oh, you know, my back is bothering me today, and my son was supposed to visit, but they'll just start talking. And it's like, that's one of the few points of human connection that they'll have. And these telemarketers who are extracting money for nefarious ends exploit that human loneliness in people. Right.
Yeah. It's just brutal. And I mean, in general, like you watch, like our society like has a real problem with what do people do when they quote unquote, like serve their time and like come out, like, what does society offer them? And like, it offers them this, like it offers like people who have talents and things to apply to society, a way to just exploit other people, because what else are they supposed to do? And like, there are extreme ends of this, like the guy who killed someone. And then there are people who just struggle with addiction or grew up poor and got into trouble, and then they get out and this place, I mean, the fact that like CDG was like going to halfway houses and pulling people in, it's like, yeah, of course these people need jobs. Like you don't get like a jobs package when you leave prison. Like, it's good luck, go figure it out. And you're mostly going to get shown the door. And so for this to be like their window into supporting themselves, it's just so upsetting from all sides, because just like so many people in this process are screwed over. It's like the police office, however you feel about police officers, police unions, like all that aside, like the people who are hurt and injured, like they don't get anything.
Their stories are being exploited so that other people can be enriched, basically.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. But great point about how these ex-cons, basically. Many of these ex-cons mm-hmm. are very talented at conversing with people, but they have no real outlet to do that, or no real lucrative outlet to do that, and this is one of them. So of course people do this, right? Like that, it makes sense. And speaking of like where society is, I think I wanted to return to one point you made earlier. I meant to double click on this, but the scene with Pat J. Pespis and Senator Blumenthal at the end, I do think that what appeals to me about the show is it's ultimately about how difficult it is to effect any change in society, right? That's ultimately what one of the theses of the show is here are people who've uncovered a massive scandal. They have like firsthand experience being inside the boiler room, and they have some amount of resources to try and expose that scandal. Can't really do anything about it. Like they've talked to every single person. You know, the one thing they can do is record all this and put it out on HBO so that people like you and me can talk about it. But mm-hmm. essentially what the documentary uncovers is that telemarketing firms are being extremely deceptive when calling and saying they represent fraternal orders of police, but that sometimes fraternal orders of police are in on it, but that nothing has been able to be done to expose these orders of police because they're extremely powerful. And you know, no lawmakers are willing to go after them, and so the injustices continue. That's kind of what the storyline of the show is, and I do think that's a very powerful storyline that the show does do a good job of getting across. It clashes with the triumphant nature of that ending, where he's like looking at the photo and very proud of himself. But I don't think they're necessarily like contradicting each other. I think they're like intention that he still feels like he had a good journey, even though nothing of value was really accomplished beyond the information getting out there.
Yeah, he met a U.S. senator. Like that is impressive that they got their foot in the door for these two. When you look at the footage that was being uploaded to early YouTube, like these are people like who were doing drugs and getting drunk at work, and now they have a series on HBO, and got to meet a senator. And it's true that this doesn't end with, you know, text at the end that explains, and as a result, all their work, they got a hearing. You know, like that's sort of the kind of thing that you expect at the end of this. Although I do wish there had been like something at the end that like got us up to date on like just the characters.
Or just some context of like, you know, telemarketers currently make 18 million calls per year. So, you know, like something to explain like what is the significance of what we just, you know, even if it's still going on, like just explaining what's going on still, like that would be great to know.
And let me know that Pat J. Pespis has opened an Instagram and he's posted one photo. And if you want to follow him, like you can. Yeah. But the thing I'll be curious about is because I think this part of where this exists in the current culture is that it's extremely difficult to get anything done through what feel like the traditional means. We're like, I vote for the right person. They go to Congress. They should do the right thing. Less bad things should happen. More good things should happen. And bad people should go to jail. And these are obviously bad things and nobody's going to jail. But the society we actually live in is that things tend to occur more quickly due to social pressure, using actions, mediums, platforms that have almost nothing to do with the people we are voting into Congress. And so there are lots of problems with internet detectives, social media mobs. But what I'm curious about the fallout from something like this is it puts in a very interesting contextual package and assigns name and blame to specific people that have broadly been anonymous until this documentary. And while I'm sure this, I haven't seen a ton of people talking about this show, so I don't think it's like reached zeitgeist status. Like their profile is raised higher than it's ever been in terms of being exposed to an average everyday person who could see them on the street, who could like find a social media profile of them and explain why what they're doing is monstrous. And so that's where I wonder where all this heads is like, yes, on one hand, like the documentary itself doesn't leave you in a place where it feels like anything much has changed except for these two main characters. But it almost is as though, as a lot of this stuff happens these days, the documentary is just an object that is then given to the culture. And like, what does the culture do with it after that? And so that's just something we can't say too much about unless you've read anything about like what have been any of the consequences or reverberations from the release of this. I haven't done a ton of research into that myself, but it's like, it would not shock me if it's not going to take down telemarketing, but does it spur something? Does it cause a person to resign as a result of like people like suddenly like realizing like this person at like the Fraternal Order of Police, yada, yada. Like that is definitely where this can be valuable as a societal cultural object, even if it doesn't result in like the takedown of the telemarketing industry at the end, because that was unrealistic to begin with.
As usual, really well said. And you're right. Like having these people's names and faces out there in the world may actually effect some kind of change. David D in the chat says telemarketers succeeded when it reached for the wire sized David Simon level systems analysis, the telemarketing industry and how it rose to power with intersections of police and poor. I completely agree. And it was really strong when it did that stuff and was focused less on the pache pespis of it all, in my opinion. But
yeah,
and you can hear, by the way, we're talking about like the stuff that's really interesting that we're talking about, in my opinion, is not pache pespis's journey. It's about like, what is wrong with society that prevents us from fixing this problem that everyone recognizes is a problem, you know?
I mean, in that moment where, in the office of Senator Blumenthal, where they're like, you know, they're in the documentary, they're rolling some archival footage of him as a, you know, a state's attorney general and like going after like firms like CDG. And then also on that wall is police patches from all over the state that he represents. And it's just like, it dawns upon you in that moment, like, this isn't going anywhere. This is not someone who is going to help us. And I think even in a, obviously I think someone who was not pache pespis could have made that point better. The point was made by the camera panning to that, where it's like, this is just someone, you know, pulled a string that got you 15 minutes. If that, it really felt like 5 minutes, with the senator. The rest was just going to be swept under the rug.
Indeed. All right, Patrick Klepek. Anything else you want to discuss about telemarketers?
I guess this is less of a me observation as much as what I'm curious to ask you as someone that just has a much broader sense of the state of documentaries. Like, what do you make of the form arriving at something like this over the longer arc of the form of a documentary, the medium? Like it's like when we arrive at this, which is like, again, I think like it's true crime documentary in like quotes, because it exists in that universe, but not necessarily in the form that we expect. Just like as someone who's a fan of the form, like how does it feel to watch something like this arrive alongside this arc of like Netflix pop turning documentaries into pop culture?
I don't know that I really feel like it's an arrival, you know, in the sense that I think that there have been other documentaries about the making of the documentaries, you know, and typically, like, I'll just throw out a couple, like Super Size Me, you know, that's just one example, right? I think like those movies all really depend on how much you like the personalities, right? And this is another documentary where it's like they tried to, it's ostensibly about this big systematic issue, but then ultimately a large part of it hangs on the personality. It's personality driven filmmaking, which I don't oppose at all, you know, but I think it's going to really depend on how much you like the personalities.
Well, they bring up Michael Moore several times, right? Like Michael Moore is their direct inspiration, and you know, Michael Moore, complicated, figure filmmaker, but like part of the strengths of his work is, and like if you view this as amateur Michael Moore, it makes a lot more sense, because they're trying to do exactly like, we're going to rush in the door and like get in their face. And part of what Michael Moore provides back when he was sort of at the height of his powers was a catharsis for the viewer, which is, I'm not going to necessarily enact change, but I'm going to get in the face of somebody who can and essentially tell them, fuck you, but with facts. And he was very good at providing emotional catharsis to people who were fed up with certain top, you know, whether it was the insurance industry, like the medical insurance industry, whether it was the handling of 9/11. And that's the vibe they're going for here, with just none of the ability to pull that off.
Right. None of Michael Moore's honestly formidable skills as a filmmaker and as an on-screen personality.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think I definitely got that was the influence. And it got me thinking, Patrick, like, why aren't there more Michael Moores out in the world? Like, why isn't it happening more often? And I think part of the answer is it is happening, right? It's just happening at a much higher frequency and at a kind of lower level than Michael Moore. Like, when Michael Moore released Fahrenheit 9/11, I'm pretty sure that movie made, I want to say, close to $100 million.
Yeah, something, real money.
Something outrageous.
Like, yeah.
Which was like, honestly, you know, something, it made box office $220 million.
I saw it in a theater, and yeah. I was in high school, and I didn't care about any of this stuff, but it was a pop culture.
Yeah, that was a cultural event, right? Now, here's the thing. You don't need to have a film crew to pull off what Michael Moore did in that show. Everyone has cell phones now, but also, as people have gotten more smartphones and more recording technology, so has corporate infrastructure adapted to prevent Michael Moore's from intruding on the, like, mm-hmm. people now know, like, you notice most of these places, they weren't even able to get into the front door, right? Because yeah. They know now. They know, like, hey, if anyone comes with a camera, if anyone even comes holding a cell phone suspiciously, they're out. Like, kick them, you know? And so mm-hmm. what Michael Moore attempted back then is largely impossible today. And I think this documentary shows that, right?
Yeah,
it shows why there aren't more documentaries like this. It's because often you don't succeed. So now that I'm talking about it like this, it is impressive how far they were able to get. Right? but yeah, I think in general, but how far they were able to get, not very far. And in general, it's very, very difficult to do these gotcha things because everyone is prepared for them now, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Everyone is aware and ready to go. And what Michael Moore achieves is largely impossible today. And this documentary shows that. So yeah, it's kind of quaint. My response to your question, kind of quaint. Kind of a quaint idea that we can show up with a camera and get them on camera saying a damning thing. And it's like, you're not even going to get into the building sometimes, right? Which mm-hmm. is what happens.
Yeah, I think that's right.
So anyway, I mean, and to be fair, Michael Moore got ejected from his share of buildings as well. But he also
frequently, that's part of the point, right? Like, yeah, the getting right. eject, like the showing the hostility to just yeah. asking a question was a huge part of his bit. And here, like, they only managed to pull it off like once, going into a police union in yeah. Florida, and it's a powerful moment. Like, you see the power of, like, having people act hostile to you over just, like, showing up to an appointment that you know what I mean?
I don't know. I feel like the power of that has declined over the last few decades.
I think that's definitely, like, true as well.
Like, back then, if Michael Moore shows up with a camera and it says, hey, we're like, tell me about why you know, these workers didn't get their medical bills paid or whatever, and they'd be like, no comment, cover the camera, you know, like,
yeah.
That's damning. Now that's just literally normal everyday behavior, right? Like, if people didn't do that, that would be surprising to me, right? But now everyone expects that. So,
well, and there's the others, yeah. They, for a brief period, they kind of connect with a journalist at Politico that has covered this. Yeah. I really wish one of those things, like, really wish she had gotten, like, a little more intertwined with what right. they were doing, instead of just being sort of a kind of a consultant and a
she should have been making the documentary, probably.
yeah, she might. Yeah. But she has a moment where she explains, you know, like, she got thrown out of a place for asking questions. So it goes to show, it's like, it's not just like a Pat J. Pespis trying to do a Michael Moore gotcha. It's a trained, legitimate right, yeah. journalist who has been doing this for years, who has a lot of, like, a really lauded reputation for this specific topic, is also getting yelled at and told to leave, because that is just the nature of, and frankly, you are rewarded in today's culture for telling people who want to say you're doing something wrong to get the F out. Like, you are going to get your side riled up just as much by showing hostility is rewarded as opposed to seeing as a mark of shame. And I do think this is something the documentary doesn't get into.
I wonder what
lot.
Could have happened recently in society to make happen.
I think in a more full feature documentary, and like, this is the kind of thing where, like, if there was another one I could watch tangential to this, I would. But there's a brief moment, and they barely touch on it in the documentary, where they are playing calls from it's when we pick up back in present day, and we're clearly like in the last five-ish years, probably even sooner than that. Like, it seems like it's like kind of post Black Lives Matter or amidst that, in which the calls that are coming in are like, people hate the police these days. Like, do you know what they're trying to defund the police? And I think that that's all a part, like, this kind of like cultural change.
Ginning up outrage about that, to be clear. Like, that people are out, you know, you the recipient of this call and me the caller are outraged that people are trying to defund the police. Yeah.
Correct. And that's like a moment where they kind of touch on it with those calls, and then they move on to kind of give you a sense of how these calls have changed. But I could have watched an entire like spinoff that was just about the last like 5-6 years, right? Like the kind of like the Trump and like Biden era of presidencies, like, has created probably massive cultural shifts in like how these calls are handled and how they exploit hostility, rage, political divide to probably make more money than they've ever been making before. We don't get the numbers at the end, but my guess is those numbers say, whoop, like, just business is good.
Fair enough. I think you're probably right about that. Well, Patrick, shall we wrap it up?
Sure.
Overall, I think a lot of thought-provoking stuff in the documentary, worth checking out. Some of the executional elements are going to be an acquired taste, but it's definitely got me thinking about, again, how difficult it is to make change in this society, how systems can exploit the weak and the poor and people who don't know any better. My favorite line from the show was one of the people. I think the former FTC guy.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no. The website watchdog person.
Yes.
He says, hey, so how should people handle these telemarketers? He's like, when they call you, hang up. That's it. If there's one thing you can take away from this conversation, if you get a call from a telemarketer, just don't even need to justify it. Don't even need to say, sorry, I'm not interested. Just hang up. Don't even say anything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So anyway, thank you so much for listening. Again, I want to remind folks, next week we're going to be tackling How To with John Wilson. And please let us know what you want us to cover this fall over at decodingtv.com or at decodingtv@gmail.com. And find more episodes of this podcast at podcast.decodingtv.com. Subscribe. Make sure you get every update as it goes live. And a huge thanks to paid members at decodingtv.com for making this podcast possible. Find more of Patrick Klepek's work at Remap Radio, available wherever podcasts can be downloaded, as well as at his newsletter, crossplay.news. He is Patrick Klepek. I am David Chen. You're listening to This Week in Streaming, a Decoding TV podcast. We will see you folks next week. Goodbye.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.